This is a Triple J podcast.
Hack. Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. Could Elon Musk's reputation tank Tesla? The EV car maker's dominance is being threatened. Some bad sales figures already being posted this year. Now, everyone's trying to figure out why. Some people are blaming Chinese competitors that are offering a better deal. Others are saying, no, it's falling demand. Not as many people want EVs. But also, others are saying it could be Elon's toxic personality. That's what they've called it. We're going to look into Tesla's fortunes overseas and here in Australia later on this podcast. But also, Elon is the polarizing billionaire. Like, has he hit his peak or is he set to become a whole lot more powerful? Because we know Elon Musk has his fingers in a lot of different pies. What's next for him? Also coming up, using your super to buy a house. Have you done it? Is it a good idea? We're going to look into that. First though,
hack. I don't see ultimately any security for Israel without the issue of Palestinian statehood being resolved.
On Triple J.
Over the past few months, I'm guessing you would have heard the term two-state solution. But do you know what it means? No Australian government has officially recognised a Palestinian state, but the government's just announced it's thinking about it. In a bit, we're going to get into what a two-state solution actually means, talk about which countries already recognise a state of Palestine. But first, Ellie Grounds has the latest on what the government said today.
Because the simple truth is that a secure and prosperous future for both Israelis and Palestinians will only come with a two-state solution. Recognition of each other's right to exist. A Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel.
It's a topic that the Labor Party has debated for years, whether or not to recognise a Palestinian state. No Australian government has ever made that call, and the current one isn't committing to it yet.
Penny Wong, is Australia ready and willing to recognise Palestine as a state?
Look, we've made no such decision.
Okay, but these latest developments are a big deal. Foreign Minister Penny Wong said in a speech in Canberra last night that the government is considering recognising Palestine. And this morning, she doubled down.
Peace, security for Israel will only be achieved if we have a Palestinian state alongside the Israeli state.
If you're confused about what the hell a two-state solution would look like, how we got here and why it's so controversial, we're going to get to that in a bit. But first, let's hear what people have had to say in response to Penny Wong's statement.
Is preconditioned on the fact that there is security and that there is a recognition and respect for the mutual right of each party to exist. That's not the current conditions, and what Penny Wong seems to be suggesting is some type of fast-tracked or preemptive recognition of Palestinian statehood.
The opposition is also broadly in favour of a two-state solution. But Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Birmingham says now is not the time to be talking about it. The head of the Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network reckons it definitely is.
It's in fact 76 years too late. Palestine should never have been divided into an Arab and Jewish state. Rather, it should have always been one state.
The opposition says Hamas, the organisation responsible for the October 7 terrorist attack and that controls Gaza, needs to be out of the picture first.
There can be absolutely no role for Hamas, which means Hamas needs to be removed as a terrorist threat and from any influence in governance.
To be clear, the government says that too.
Hamas has no place in Gaza.
Some Jewish people reckon it would essentially reward Hamas for the October 7 attacks. But Penny Wong reckons recognising Palestine would mean that other Arab countries would decide to recognise Israel, and that would actually contribute to Hamas's demise. The peak Jewish organisation in Australia reckons the Australian government is lecturing its ally.
Israel knows how to conduct this war. It knows what it needs to do to defend its territory, its citizens, to free its hostages. This is a time when key allies like Australia need to stand in solidarity with Israel and show understanding, rather than to give these sorts of policy suggestions at such a critical time.
So now that's out of the way, what the hell is the two-state solution? Right now, many countries do not recognise Palestine as its own state. There are two Palestinian territories, Gaza and the West Bank, but they're cut off from each other and occupied by the Israeli military. Plus, the West Bank is dotted with Israeli settlements that are illegal under international law. For decades, there have been wars between Israelis and Palestinians and discussions about how the land could be split up between them.
The General Assembly of the United Nations has made its decision on Palestine. The map shows what partition means. The Jewish state coloured light, the Arab state dark,
but there has never been total agreement. In 1988, the head of the Palestinian Liberation Organisation declared Palestine independent. He also accepted a partition plan and the existence of Israel, and that paved the way for a really significant agreement.
This laid a foundation for Palestinian self-rule, although numerous difficult points remained to be worked out between the eternal enemies. At last, peace had a hope. The two men making these promises on behalf of their peoples were jointly awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace.
But those agreements, called the Oslo Accords, never actually spelled out how a two-state solution would work practically. Groups on both sides weren't happy, and years of terrorist attacks, fighting and bloodshed followed. And 36 years on, a solution still hasn't been implemented. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu isn't going to budge anytime soon.
Israel categorically rejects international edicts on a permanent arrangement with the Palestinians. Israel will continue to oppose unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state.
Hack on Triple J.
Ellie Grounds with that update. Want to get into this a bit more now with Dr. Andrew Thomas, a lecturer in International Relations and Middle East Studies at Deakin Uni. He's used to unpacking this really complicated stuff for young people, for students every day. He's with us now. Hey, Andrew, thanks for coming on Hack.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
For a lot of us, the idea of statehood and sovereignty probably seems a bit confusing or vague. Maybe we don't understand exactly what that means, why Palestinians would be wanting this. Is statehood just a name, or is it a whole lot more than that?
Oh, it's a much, much more than that. And it's something that when you've got it, you tend to take it for granted. When you live in a state, when you have sovereign autonomy, or your state has sovereign autonomy, that actually affords you certain rights. Even if you're not in your state and you're going on a holiday overseas and something happens to you, your state can advocate for you. Sovereignty gives power to the state that, in theory, gives power to the people. Now, there are problems with that as well. Some sovereign states don't afford their people certain rights. But we do often take for granted that we belong to a sovereign state and that we're subject to and protected by its laws. That's the key difference between sovereignty and a lack of sovereignty. Now, what's also confusing about this subject is that it is unfortunately subjective. 139 nations have recognized the state of Palestine as a sovereign state. However, it doesn't have anything beyond an observer status in the UN, meaning that it can't vote on General Assembly issues. And it is not recognized by primarily the country that is occupying its territory, which is Israel. Often sovereignty is disputed, but it does require a collective recognition of it for it to be enforceable.
Probably pretty interesting for people to hear 139 countries already recognise the state of Palestine. What's the magic number then? Like, is there a certain number for a state to be considered recognised formally?
It's not so much that there's a magic number. There are magic states. Those two states are the United States and Israel. They are the magic numbers for giving Palestine sovereignty. We can open embassies in the West Bank. We can open embassies in Gaza and conduct diplomatic relations with the Palestinians in that way. But the reality is that if Israel refuses to recognize the Palestinians as a sovereign entity, then they are not, because they become subject to Israeli laws.
So you've said that if Israel and the US don't recognise Palestine as a state, it doesn't make too much of a difference. Does that mean Australia potentially recognising a Palestinian state wouldn't mean much in the scheme of things?
On the contrary, the more that the United States is alone on this issue, the more that Israel and the United States are alone on the issue, the more pressure it puts on both of those states. The United States has said that the solution to this conflict is a two-state solution. That is the only one. And that obviously requires a recognition of Palestine as a state. Now, currently it's balancing its close relationship, its special relationship with Israel, with that desire to actually solve the conflict. Because that's really what most members of the international community want, is a resolution to it. But it is just words at this point. Australia is still pretty far away from taking that extra step, voting for example, Palestinians to be recognised in the UN as a state, giving them a vote, opening an embassy, an Australian embassy in the West Bank, for example, would be a huge step, and treating Palestinians like a state. But as we know, there are a myriad of different barriers to that. not just in terms of the international politics of it, but also the internal politics.
I was going to ask about that. What are some of those barriers in the sense that for a two-state solution to be viable, how would leadership work in terms of government, for instance? If you've got two separate leaderships in the West Bank and in Gaza, that would clearly need to be sorted out.
Essentially, yes. Part of the outcome of this conflict that we're currently in is that a lot of people are saying that all the Palestinian causes are the same. That could not be further from the truth. There is a big schism between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, PLO. In fact, there was a very, very bloody war fought between the two of them for control over the Palestinian Authority. Hamas won an election 17 years ago. Because Israel and the United States refused to deal with Hamas, they essentially gave all the power to Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. So there's no love lost between Hamas and the PLO. They really don't like each other. And that would have to be resolved before any kind of two-state solution could work.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Dr. Andrew Thomas from Deakin Uni, an expert in Middle East studies, on the news out today that the Australian government's thinking about recognising Palestine as a state. Andrew, there seems to have been a real shift in the international community recently. Like, you're starting to see countries like the UK, like Australia, speaking out more about this issue. But then on the other side, you've seen this massive escalation in violence and fighting in Gaza, for example, in the West Bank. Do you think Palestinian state recognition is more or less likely to happen now?
Yeah, that's quite the question. If it really depends on who you would ask. Quite a lot of members of the Israeli government, their goal isn't necessarily to solve this conflict in an equitable way. Arguably, most of the criticism levied at Benjamin Netanyahu's government in particular have said that, well, Israel only wants to solve this conflict on their terms and that the compromise is off the table. Though others would say that Hamas is kind of the same. Their motivations isn't necessarily resolution to this conflict, but to position themselves as kind of the rightful leaders of the Palestinian people. Certainly the international community has shifted significantly, at least some states have, on this issue. The United States has changed its tune very significantly, particularly over the last couple of weeks. So we are seeing a big shift, enormous shift in the international community. Hopefully that's enough to put pressure on this conflict to have a long-term solution, not just to this war, but this war will happen over and over again, as Minister Wong says, if there is not an ongoing solution addressing the core concerns of the Palestinian people for their self-determination. Can't go on like this. And she's right in saying that the longer Palestinians don't have their self-determination, the longer Israelis are unsafe.
I mean, those against this move say it's rewarding extremism, terrorism, that it could make the situation a lot worse, that now's not the time. What's your take on that?
It shouldn't be ignored that the tactics used by Hamas constitute war crimes. Does that mean that you turn around and start negotiating directly with Hamas and sort of giving them political legitimacy? No. But there are other representatives of the Palestinian nationhood, Palestinian national self-determination. There's one that Israel gave legitimacy in the West Bank that they could empower. We have to understand that it's uncomfortable for the Israelis to negotiate with some of these groups. But the reality is you don't make peace with your friends. Make peace with your enemies. If the goal is to solve this conflict, there needs to be a political solution to this.
Well, thank you very much for your take on all of this. Dr. Andrew Thomas from Deakin Uni, appreciate you coming on Hack.
Thank you.
Hack. If you didn't know what super was, it's like Australia's 401k. It's our retirement fund.
On Triple J.
When was the last time you looked at your super balance? Superannuation. Is it better or worse than you thought it would be? Maybe you've got none at all and it freaks you out. You're thinking, oh, what am I going to do? That's a long way down the track though. I'm not worrying about it now. If you do have some, it's easy to dream about what you would do with that money that is stashed away. It's yours. It's so close, but it's so far. Well, some are using it to help them buy a house. You've probably heard about this in the past, but is it a good idea? Shalala Madora has been looking into it.
In 2022, while trying to win an election, Scott Morrison made this promise.
A re-elected coalition government will allow first home buyers to invest a responsible portion of their own superannuation savings into their first home.
In a nutshell, the policy aimed to give young people a leg up in the housing market by letting them raid their super.
But this will be a game changer for thousands of Australian families who sit and look at that money on their balance and go, if only I had that to help me now.
The thing is, it mightn't be that easy.
If you are having trouble accessing the housing market outside of super, then your superannuation balance is of no help to you. In fact, it will be really detrimental for your retirement if you're to drain it and access housing in that way.
Mary Della Hunty is the head of the Association of Superannuation Funds Australia. They looked at the super balances of 300,000 people aged 25 to 34 and compared it with median home prices. The results were particularly bad for people living in Sydney.
Whether or not you're earning money, well, good money outside of super or not, that if you are a couple or a single in Sydney, you are locked out of the housing market, full stop.
In Melbourne, only the top 20% of income earners will have enough super to cover a deposit for an apartment. Turns out, people in their 20s and 30s don't really have enough years of work behind them to have enough in their super to cover home deposits. The most recent stats we have from the tax office found people in their 20s have an average balance of just $17,000 in their super. And those who would benefit from this system risk driving up prices for everyone.
The headline, I suppose, of this particular finding is that this is not fair. It's not fair to ask people to access their superannuation to fix a structural problem that they didn't cause in the first place. It's not fair to ask people of a younger generation to do something that the older generation didn't have to do.
Well, if you ask the super funds if they should be able to keep all our money for 40 years without question, I think they're going to say that they would like to keep it. So I take their research with a grain of salt. I mean, effectively, it's like Dracula running the blood bank.
Senator Andrew Bragg is the Coalition's spokesperson on housing affordability. He backs the idea of dipping into your super, which, by the way, is still the Coalition's official housing policy, even after their 2022 election loss.
Owning your own house is the best thing you can do for your retirement. And the key determinant of that retirement is going to be your home ownership status.
He reckons people should have the flexibility to use their own money as they see fit.
So the super funds have a huge vested interest in keeping the status quo, but I think that we should have a system where people can choose if they want to use their own money that they've worked hard for to get into the home ownership market.
Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Medora with that story. Different opinions on the text line. Simon in Wodonga says, unfortunately, it just drives up house prices. More money to spend means more people trying to spend it. It doesn't solve the root cause.
Hack. Has Elon Musk alienated the people who he needs to buy Teslas?
He certainly has.
On Triple J.
What do you think of Elon Musk? If you love him, you probably follow all his updates on X. You're keen to see what new venture he's launching or predictions he's making for the future. If you're against him, maybe his reputation was enough to drive you away from using his social media platform or potentially ever owning a Tesla. Because Tesla's worldwide sales are down for this year for the first time in a long time. Some are blaming Elon's antics as part of the reason. But as Angus McIntosh finds out, here in Australia, it might not be as simple as that.
At this point, I think I know more about manufacturing than anyone currently alive on Earth.
Do you recognise that voice? That's Tesla CEO and self-appointed techno king Elon Musk. He's been riding high for a few years now. He was the world's richest man until February, and Tesla is still the world's most valuable car company by a mile. He also bought Twitter for $44 billion and renamed it X. But lately, all is not well in the world of Elon.
Tesla's quarterly numbers are out and investors are disappointed.
There's been growing talk about the global electric vehicle revolution faltering.
Tesla's been the global poster kid for electric transport during a decade of incredible progress. Tesla's Model S sedan weighs more than 2 tons and accelerates faster than every single supercar sold today. The Model Y was the top-selling car in the world last year. So why the 8% dip in sales?
We have plenty of anecdotal data where people will say they won't buy a Tesla because they don't want to be associated with him or his political beliefs or his stance or on various issues.
I'm chatting here with motoring writer James Ward.
I wrote an opinion piece last year that said I'd like to drive a Tesla, but I don't want to be a Tesla driver because you're sort of dealing with an almost cult-like user base there.
So is it this stereotype of the Tesla fanboy loving the antics of their meme emperor Elon Musk that's starting to hurt sales? Well, that was the deal breaker for Rory from Melbourne.
I was initially interested in Tesla. Well, he managed to hook a few of my mates and turn them into passionate EV nerds, but now it feels like it's all a means to an end for him to get more capital for his space fetish. He's extremely xenophobic and racist towards a lot of immigrants, especially in America, who he relies on to work in his factories and keep his business costs at a minimum so he can pay cheap labour.
Rory's worries about what buying a Tesla might say about him aren't unique. Plenty of Aussies online are saying exactly the same thing. But Tesla is still doing better here now than in a lot of other parts of the world, at least according to EV Council CEO Biyad Jafari.
Every Tesla that lands on Australian shores is already sold by the time it arrives here. You know, we sold almost 100,000 electric vehicles last year. Sales grew by 120%.
Biyad says Tesla makes up about half of all the EVs sold in Australia, with the Chinese brand BYD coming in second. In Europe and Asia, other cheap Chinese or Korean brands are aggressively eating into Tesla's share. James Ward says that's just not happening here to the same extent.
You see other markets like Europe and Asia who have these electric microcars that are, you know, $15,000, $16,000 equivalent. They would never sell in Australia. They've got no airbags. They've got no safety systems. They would not pass our design and safety requirement.
Oh, and by the way, those Australian design rules could be a problem for Tesla's new stainless steel ute, the Cybertruck, making it down here too. Americans have had the truck since December, and Elon says he's got 200,000 reservations just waiting for the factory to catch up. But James reckons in Australia, it might be a different story.
It's a toy. We'll never see it here because it'll never be developed as right-hand drive. It would never meet Australian safety standards.
I work with trains and I've seen the way vehicles crumple and things like that. And modern cars are designed to crush up into a ball to absorb the shock and not transfer it onto the passengers, whereas his thing is a death box.
So, Cybertruck or not, how big is this problem for Tesla? And is it getting worse? Well, Elon's been here before. And when advertisers started pulling away from X last November, he just doubled down.
If somebody's going to try to blackmail me with advertising, blackmail me with money, go f*** yourself. But go f*** yourself. Is that clear?
Hack on Triple J.
It's clear. How much more clearer can you get? I don't know. We've got some messages coming through, people's opinions on Elon. Someone says he's just a rich loser, like the kid at school that buys everyone's stuff from the tuck shop. Another person, though, says, I actually like the way Elon thinks, but I think electric cars are way too expensive and not all that green. That was from Zach in Hobart. I want to get into the world of Tesla and Elon Musk a little bit more now. Nick Bonihady is a technology writer at the Australian Financial Review and has been writing about Elon Musk and Tesla for years. He's with us now. Hey, Nick, thanks for coming on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think that Tesla has an Elon problem, as we've been hearing?
I think it has an Elon problem and it also has a huge Elon boom. Musk invested in Tesla and then drove it as its CEO and pivotal figure for years, turning it from something that no one thought would work into the most dominant electric car manufacturer in the world. But lately, it just hasn't been delivering the kind of performance and the number of vehicles that people thought it would.
It's interesting, right? I was going to ask you if you think his behaviour, sometimes bizarre, his big opinions, polarising views make him more or less popular. It sounds like you're saying it's a bit of both.
Yeah, I think for a certain cohort of people, Musk is a truth teller. He's someone willing to say things that aren't popular, but that they really engage with. And that goes for people in Silicon Valley and really wealthy investors. Like, let's not forget that he was able to drum up billions and billions of dollars to by Twitter, for example. That speaks to the faith that some sophisticated and powerful people have in Elon. On the other hand, he makes remarks that are really outrageous, and he's been accused of anti-Semitism and all sorts of other things. There was actually this deposition recently where Elon was asked by a lawyer for a guy who was suing him about whether he thought that his tweets were helpful for his finances, and he was pretty transparent in saying, not really, or not always, but he said that he thought that they were so entertaining and so informative, his words, that he was going to keep doing them anyway. And for people who might want to buy a Tesla, who might tend to be kind of environmentally and socially conscious people, that could be a huge turnoff.
As we've just heard, Tesla sales aren't suffering too much here, but overseas there are some real issues. What do you think some of the other problems facing Tesla are?
So beyond Elon, Tesla is just a general manufacturer, and that means that it has to contend with an economy that's not going nearly as well as it was, and that's denting demand, and also the price point at which these vehicles are offered at. Tesla is a luxury car maker, but a lot of people just want an electric vehicle that they can drive around, pick up their kids from school, go on a little holiday in, and Tesla doesn't have an affordably priced electric vehicle, whereas some of its major competitors in China have established a real hold on that part of the market, and that's hurting its demand. There's also some supply chain problems. There was a fire at a factory in Berlin, but I think that's the main one that's hurting this business.
Just back onto Elon, is he facing some of the similar issues maybe he's facing with Tesla with other companies like SpaceX, for example, this issue of his personality affecting business, affecting sales?
SpaceX is a really interesting one because it controls the Starlink satellite network, and that is a way that people can communicate via satellite, making phone calls or looking up websites on their phones, even if they're well outside of a normal tower range for mobile phone coverage. And that's landed Elon in the hot water of having to weigh into the Ukraine crisis, because Starlink has been a pivotal way for Ukraine to get online. And that's landed him in all sorts of problems because he has expressed views on how the conflict should be settled, what Ukraine should do regarding Russia and vice versa. But the other thing is that because Elon has so many different companies, they kind of buttress each other. His power begets more power, and it's very hard to account for one because he has so many other power bases that he can fall back on.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Nick Bonahady from the Australian Financial Review. We're talking Elon Musk and Tesla and all things about this billionaire who really divides opinion. People love him, people hate him. Nick, do you think we could be seeing more of Elon in Australia in the years ahead? Like, do you predict he's going to expand his presence here?
Yeah, almost certainly. So Starlink is getting more and more capable. That's the satellite network. And there are companies in Australia, including Optus, that have deals to deliver Starlink coverage to people. So he could be responsible for the way that huge numbers, perhaps millions of Australians, ultimately end up communicating. And then there's his charger network that's expanding for Teslas and other vehicles. So if you're filling up your car at the electric Bowser or making a phone call, you could be thanking or relying on Elon Musk.
Interesting stuff. I mean, he is one of the richest men on the planet. He was the richest at some point, has slid a little over recent years. Do you think we've seen him at his peak, Nick, or do you think he's going to become more powerful?
I think that depends on how his artificial intelligence venture goes. Elon Musk was one of the figures involved in the creation and funding of OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT the tool that lots of people have played around with to generate images or screens of text. But he split off from that venture and is trying to create his own AI tools stemming off from Twitter. And if that goes well, that could be a whole other business venture for Elon Musk that comes into our lives. Alternatively, maybe he ends up restraining his personality and dialing it back. And that could also be helpful. If he retains the kind of charisma but isn't as publicly visible, that could lead to a new and more effective Elon. I don't think we've seen the last of him by any stretch.
No, I don't think so. Restraining his personality, I'm not sure that fits in. But we thank you for your time, Nick Bonahady from the Australian Financial Review. Thanks for explaining it to us.
Thank you so much.
Hack. On Triple J.
Yeah, different opinions from people on Elon and Tesla. T from Tullamarine says Elon is his own worst enemy. He's a megalomaniac, destroyed Twitter and gave voice to dangerous and hateful speech. I'm a rideshare driver wanting to go EV, but I'll never own a Tesla. Hayden from Cranbourne says, I'm looking to purchase a new car and EVs are on my radar. After Elon's behaviour, though, I chose not to buy a Tesla. And someone else says, we bought a Tesla because it was actually more affordable than others. Definitely not just luxury, but a good car. A lot of opinions there. Huge amount of engagement today. Thank you so much for contributing to the show. We'll be back tomorrow for another episode of the Hack Podcast. I'll catch you then. See ya. Hack.